the last class we talked about, or we started with object space, which basically provides an option for processes to communicate and interact with each other via an shared memory. Therefore, it's not necessary that the two processes or the interacting processes basically have overlapping lifetimes. They can be completely completely separate with their lifetimes, and they are still a fairly easy way that they can interact with. We had last time the basic operations like write, read, and take, and the matching rules were basically or access to elements in the space were done in a way that first we prepare a template where some of the attributes are specified, some of the attributes are open, and they are only constrained with respect to their data type. And the Java spaces or the management of the shared memory basically searches for an entry in the space which matches the template object. And the template object, it uses the class. It looks as if the two object classes match, the entry class and the template class, or the template class is a superclass, then wildcards, they basically match the corresponding object field, and if a field is specified, then the values have to be the same. And with read, we just read the entry. With take, we take it out. And the other additional thing is we can use it also as a way to not wait, basically block until an entry is available. We can also have something like a registration of notification. Therefore, in that sense, and that's done with this event and the notify, that basically the client which is interested in certain objects or certain entries basically sends a request for notification to the space. And it provides here the template, and that's the template of the entries it is interested in. And then when later on another process basically puts an entry in it, an object which matches the template, then basically here the process 2 is notified that now an entry is available. And now the process can make a lookup for the tuple or for the object. I mean, we talk about the object that matches the template T, and then it can be returned to the process, either as being read or as being taken out. What you have to look at it, there are race conditions. And one of the race conditions you can think of, that for example, if you have a process P3 and the process P2 gets notified that the entry is available, but before it acts, this process does something like a take. And that would mean that here the object is taken out, and when here the process 2 makes a lookup, the object C is gone again. Therefore, in that sense, notification does not mean the object is available until the process P2 does perform its lookup. It was available when the notification is triggered, and but it can be already gone when the process P2 does its lookup. Therefore, in that sense, there's no guarantee that it's still available when the process P2 checks it. And I have here an example of using with Java spaces and especially with Nodify. And before we can look through the individual code, basic, and that's here the entry, it implements entry, and that's just a message. Here on we have here the space, then we have here the hello world notify, as I mean this process, as here hello world notify, that's below the public class. I can't move it up because otherwise my drawing is gone. And therefore, what it does, the first step, it creates a listener. And that's basically the first action what this one does. And it creates a new listener which listens to the space. And the second thing is it does here a space, that's the second action, a space notify. Therefore, it registers an event. In a sense, it provides a template, and that's the template what is what was set up, and with respect to the entry. And then the same. Therefore, I mean, usually you would program a lot more complicated with different processes, but the next step, if you look at the code, would be here. The third step, in a sense of we write a message in it, and when the message is now put into the space, it basically gets now in a fourth step, it gets a notify, and the fifth step would be here that the listener invokes a read, and then it would basically read the message here. And that's basically the steps what are done in these Java code underneath, and we can basically quickly look at it. First of all, the central piece are these hello world notify. Here it creates the listener, and then it gets a notification, and a notification is registered, and notified should be the process listener here. So here the notify listener. And when the event is available, and here the lease forever means it's there forever. And here it creates the message, and then it writes the message into the space. If we look here up now with the listener, that's the one which basically gets informed. Here it implements a remote event listener. It's export, that's object, that's part of the RMI package, and the listener is exported as a remote object, and therefore because the hello what was it? Hello World Notify creates the listener and then have the listener exist separately. And here it just it has the notification routine or method, and this is the method which is then basically executed when the space finds an event, in our case a message, be inserted into the space, and therefore this routine or this method is executed, and then that one of the first thing is here that the listener basically reads then the message newly put into the space. I mean, usually what you would do is you would do the sending of messages be done by a completely different process. And that's here just to show how the interaction between the various processes basically occur. That's all what I wanted to say to the distributed shared memory. And now the next thing would be just a quick rundown of other object-based distributed systems. Most of the object-oriented systems, what you find today, are either written in Java or in Objective-C. And Corba is a rather generic object-oriented environment which can use or can work with C++, which can work with Objective-C, which can work with Java. I mean, that's no problem. Therefore, the intention of Corba at that point was basically to enable the interoperability between heterogeneous environments and especially heterogeneous object-oriented systems. And the point here is a central aspect of Corba is this object management architecture. This is OMA. And it consists, very often the term OMA and Corba are used interchangeably, but they are actually, sorry, I'm waiting for to sneeze and I don't want to wake you up here. Therefore, they are used interchangeably, but usually the OMA, that's basically that architecture. And what we have here is, on one hand, we have these application objects, and they may, as you hear, may run on different object oriented systems. And on the other hand, you have something like predetermined services. Here, object services, and that's on a system layer, and some of it is creation and management of objects. And that's some of the services. And then we have here this common functionality, and that's something like common functions for application domain. And it could be something like that we say, well, these are banking applications. This one, this is for a logistics application domain. I mean, it's a very more defined by the business perspective. Here, these are common object services. And what you have in between is the object request broker. And or sometimes they call it also object bus. And here the application objects basically interact via these object bus or these object request broker with the different target objects. And the ORB manages the request response or request reply protocol. It also supports object localization. In a sense, here we have a name of an object, and the object request broker basically searches where the object actually is located, because here you might have completely different machines where the individual object reside on. It's a distributed environment, and it also provides then support to deliver the message to the appropriate object. It provides here the marshalling and demarshalling of parameters, and also in a sense of the synchronization between request and response messages. What the object request broker does not do, it does not execute methods. I mean, certainly the ORB provides information or provides a link towards the object services, which provide the execution of certain functions, like conversion of an object ID into a string or the reverse and things like that. The other thing is, what we can say, the ORB basically masks the differences of object-oriented systems. Also here, masks the differences of object-oriented systems. And it's really a point how like how a method is called. Like, for example, if you think of certain object-oriented systems, there are some of them where the first parameter of an invocation, of a method invocation, is basically the name of the method. And in other object-oriented systems, basically the parameter list consists only of the parameters used by the method, and the method invocation stands before the parameter list outside, let's say, the parentheses. Therefore, there's a somewhat slightly different way of syntactically describing how a method call looks. And also, some of object-oriented systems have on the first invocation the ID of the object to look at the first parameter and to find out what object is actually meant by this call. And that's these differences, how the syntactic differences look like, are basically masked by the object request broker. And that would allow to go ahead and say, well, here I start out with a Java object, which makes a method call, and I end up with a Smalltalk object on this area where the method is basically executed. And that's somewhat different from what you have with Java. In Java, you are in a Java environment where Java objects using RMI can invoke each other. And therefore, you have a pretty well-defined homogeneous environment. The next aspect we can look at the general features of the object request broker. And the structure of it, general features, here it provides two types of interfaces. Static, that's something what we already know from RPC. We can generate a static invocation interface. And there's also a dynamic method interface, and that means the binding here is at runtime. Also here, binding at runtime. And that's interesting for types of objects which where the interface is not known when the invoker is basically programmed. And it's the same thing what you have with RMI when the requesting object basically goes to the registry and imports the proxy object for the invoked object. Therefore, in that sense, you have also a late binding, because then at the time when the requesting object is programmed, the invoked object might not be completely known or might not be registered. In the same thing is here, you have a dynamic interface where you can have the invocation of objects which were not known at the programming of requesting object. It provides interfaces for higher programming languages like C++, Smalltalk, Java, and certainly there's also one C# from Microsoft. It has it's a self-descriptive system. Therefore, what it has, it's something like an interface repository. And that interface repository, it provides the information about the parameters, the functions and the parameters. So here, description of functions and parameters. And that's something similar. What you have is like when you have a registry with RMI, where you go to the RMI registry and then basically load the proxy object. Here it provides location transparency. The object might run on completely different machines, and the ORB basically tries to find it. It has a mapping to the location, and it provides security checks in a sense of authentication, and that way you can control the access to objects, and it provides a polymorphic method invocation. Therefore, in the sense, the method, the invocation depends on the object. Therefore, in that sense, first we identify the object, and then we invoke the method of that object. If we look at RPC, we know the function, and then we invoke the function. We don't really look at an object or something. Basically, the data are completely separated. Here, the data or the form of the object come first, and then come the method. Here, the function comes first, and then the data come. And they also allow hierarchical object naming. Therefore, in that sense, you have something like a hierarchy of object request brokers, of ORBs. If we look at the structure, it basically looks the following. Here you have the static interfaces, and you have an interface for every server object. You might have a separate static interface. But dynamic interface, there is only one. Also here, there is only one. And that 1 basically matches to all the potential objects to be invoked. And in that sense, it's for C programmers. It's you know the printf statement, and it's just an analogy, and therefore in that sense the printf is rather flexible, because what you have is you have something here like a format, and then you have a list of parameters. And it's basically pretty flexible. Well, do you have one parameter? Do you have two? Do you have three? I mean, it's pretty flexible, and also the data type is pretty flexible. Therefore, in that sense, in there you have something similar. It's a very flexible interface where you provide information about the parameters, and then you just list all the parameters which should be passed on to the server object. Therefore, in that sense, it can be adjusted dynamically. And how many parameters you need, that's listed in the interface repository. Therefore, if a server object is available, it has to register its information in the interface repository. That's something similar what we had with the RMI registry. And therefore, it should be available, because otherwise, in the dynamic interface, it's not really possible to set up this flexible parameter data structure. The static interfaces, the same thing on the other side are the skeletons, and you remember. In RMI, there we talked about stops and skeletons. Here we talk about interfaces and skeletons. The usage or the semantic is pretty much the same. And here you have a dynamic skeleton. And that allows you, if the information about or the invocation is of the server object is not bound to it, we can basically pass this flexible list to the server object. And then the server object basically has to, in the dynamic skeleton, basically it has to divide up the individual parameters. You have a runtime repository which basically lists all active objects. And for example, if there comes a call to the object kernel, it's passed on to the object adapter. The object adapter checks if the object is running. If it's running, then basically it passes the invocation on to the object. If it's not running, then basically the object adapter activates the object, and after the object is activated, the invocation is passed on. And if we quickly look at a few things of the components, most of the things I already mentioned. The object core interface, that's management facilities. I mean, it provides. I know. The point is here: the object core basically mediates between the requests between client and server objects. The point is here, if you remember, with RPC. And also with RMI, client and server objects basically interact directly with each other. They send the request and then receive or get the response. Here, the objects don't really interact directly with each other. It's always via the ORB core. The ORB core is in the middle, and it passes on the requests, and it receives the responses and passes it back to the client. And it provides also some functions like conversion of object references to strings and back and forth, and also to set up argument lists for a dynamic invocation. The static, well, it's available at interface at compile time. Dynamic, I already mentioned, is available only once. And I don't really go into detail, because if you look at the significance on the market, the Corba, it was promoted very much in the 90s. And then with coming of Java, and later with C# and .NET and Java, enterprise Java Beans and so on, basically the significance on the market went downhill. And there are a number of installations still available of Corba, but it's really, if you look at the market share, and it's basically most on the Java side or the Windows side, or if you go and look at Apple, then you have something like the Objective-C environment available. And Corba is, I would say, a minor market share still exists, and therefore I don't really want to go into detail, just to come up with the major things, because it also, all the structure, it was the first one, and therefore it influenced pretty strongly the whole Java environment, but also the .NET environment. The ORB interface here, the supports service calls, and here the interface repository, where you basically have the signatures of the object method invocations. Here, basically, then the client can look up, like in the RMI registry, what methods are available and what's the signatures of these methods. The adapter forwards clients calls and basically activates objects. And here the runtime repository, it's here the knowledge which object is basically activated and which objects are not running yet. The skeletons, well, I think I already talked enough about it. And because the static looks pretty much the same like the stubs from the RPC, only in the object-oriented environment. The one thing is, to look at it, the embedding, what you mostly find of the ORB, it's not a separate process or a separate entity on a computer. That basically what you find typically, it's you find it as a library function. Therefore, when you are in the client application, you have to integrate into the client application the client ORB and as a library function. And then here you have on top here, you have the client objects, you have the static interface, dynamic interface, and the ORB interface. Here you have the server ORB, and also what you have at least here is also the interface repository. That's not listed here. And here you have the ORB interface, and here you have the runtime repository for objects. I mean, here these are the repositories which are basically available here. And there are some implementations of it, like here from Orbix, Microfocus, and there's also a free platform and like the Tao system, and it's you can basically install it on your own environment. And there were other commercial products or commercial implementations, but a lot of them more or less disappeared from the market because there's just not enough market share available to sell their products, and to interesting for companies to put so much effort on the implementation of it. The one thing is what I could mention. Object services, what you have is here lifetime services. It's basically, there is a whole bunch, and some of them are as application objects. And I also mentioned these object services, which are commonly available for applications, and which are not really application specific. I mentioned before with OMA, you have something like generic object services and application-specific object services. And here, these are more or less generic object services. And life cycle service, like the life cycle of objects, then persistent service, where you have a persistent object storage associated with it, a name service, which allows interaction with other directory services and allows from the object bus, when it gets a name, to interact with an LDAP service or other object services or Genie or JNDA to check for the address. Event services, like having produce and consumer of events, concurrency control, transaction service, which provides you then the two-phase commit protocol, and therefore in that sense an application object just has to create a transaction, and then at the end it would invoke the commit, and then it either gets a success or an abort back. And it does not really handle, as you remember, the two-phase commit protocol, where you say, well, interact with the all the all the servers, get back if they are ready for commit, and if they are ready, send a do commit there. That's all handled by the transaction service and not by the application. To check relationships between objects, I mean, it's not relationships between people, it's relationship between objects, and here a query service which maps here query functions into appropriate SQL functions. The other things what I want to mention here is this inter-ORB protocol, and the point is here with inter-ORB, it's basically that, as you know, we have now an ORB at every single place where you have a CORBA installation. And the point is here that some of the ORBs manage some of the available objects. And what you need now is something like an ORB-ORB communication. And you have now here the possibility that each ORB manages the objects of its domain. And if an object is stored in another domain, it basically, you have then, if a call to an object comes, then basically the ORB communicates with its partner ORB, and there the partner ORB invokes the method of the remote object, and then it sends back the appropriate response. And the protocol what they have now here is this inter-orb protocol, or this general inter-orb protocol. And an implementation using internet technology is IIOP. And that you find very often in the context of web and also in the context of Java. And it's basically the same protocol. So here, GIOP, what do we have? We have on one hand here message formats for the individual messages like request, cancel request, and this is not a message here. I mean, I was thinking, well, what is the message end? It refers to that here. It has a common data representation, and that is similar, as here, similar to XDR, and external data representation, which we had a while ago as part of the course, when we said, how do we represent strings? How do we represent fields? How do we represent pointers? And that's similar what you have with CDR. And basically maps here, CDR basically maps data types into OMG IDL into a flat network for a network message representation. And on the receiving end, then basically the stream of bits is then mapped into data representation again. And in that sense, it's pretty much similar as XDR is. And IIOP, that's an implementation of this GIOP protocol. And you could have another implementation, basically use other specific protocols which are not internet inter-orb, like AppleTalk. You could have also AppleTalk implementation of it if you wanted to. The data representation, what we have here, and certainly you have these primitive data types which are available, like character, octet, short, long, float, double, boolean. Then we have these complex data types, as a complex parts, struct, union, sequence, symbol change, similar like strings and fields. And with struct, you can build up new complex data structures. And if you look at it, you have here the here the definition of it. Then you have an ID of the structure. That's basically the ID of structure. And then you have the name of structure. And then you have here the components of the structure. So here, components of structure. And therefore, in that sense, you are pretty, and count basically provides you information how many components you would have. And in that case, you have a pretty flexible way of defining here the representation of it. Just to say things in between, that's actually here the things here. That's not the things what we would actually ask you in the the exam. In the written exam, that we ask you how the structure here looks like. I mean, that's definitely not the case. What we would do is the another important thing is this object reference, which is used as part of IIoP, and these are basically this IOR, this inter-orb reference, and it consists of three parts. One is the IP host address, the second one is the TCP port number, and the third is an object key that's basically a unique, unique identifier at the destination ORB. Also here at destination ORB. And therefore, in that sense, that provides you then a unique identifier. Sorry, I think something else. This I stands for interoperable object reference. And and it has similar functions, as you know, with the URIs. I mean, it looks a little bit different from the structure, and but the goal is to have a representation, an ID of objects in across the network. How is the format of GIOP message? You have a message head, you have a header, which depends on the message type, like request message, reply message, and then the content. The GIOP message head looks the following. It starts with GIOP, and then it has a representation of the message type, and that's basically a representation of the head structure. And here, the magic, that's the message header, contains always here this GIOP. And it's if you look at PDF, a PDF file always has in the front as a magic the term, the string PDF. And it's something similar what you have here. You have a version. And the version, what you have is you have a major and a minor version. You have a flag octet, which basically provides you information of the byte ordering. And also it provides information if the message is divided into several fragments. And then you have here comes the message. That's basically the message header. That's here the head, and here, and then comes the size of the message, type and size, and messages do we have? And these are message types: request, reply, cancel request, locate request, locate reply, close connection, and message error. And if we look at it, request, that's just a regular request message for operation at the remote object. And the content is basically the name of the method and all the parameters. Reply, that's a response. Cancel request is to terminate the request. And the caller does not expect an answer. Locate, that's something here just to find out if the object reference is valid. And if it's not valid, then what is the address of another ORB it should be sent to? And that's here relevant to find out if an object is, for example, at a specific location And if it's not at a specific location here, the asked ORB would provide an answer which other ORB should be checked to query to find out if the object is there. That's here the answer, close connection, a message error, and here fragment. Here, if a message is divided up into several fragments. For request, usually the parameters are rather short, then it might not be fragmented, but the answer could be a fragmented answer because if the answer is rather large. And here the example use of IIOP. Here you have a web server, check with the web page or the web server. A Java applet is basically sent back to the web browser. The web browser executes then here the Java applet. That includes here also then a link to the towards the ORB, and then basically the ORB interacts via IIOP interaction. That's a possible use where you can combine legacy environments. But the point here is that if you do a migration into let's say a .NET or a pure server, web server based environment with web services, it's migration means not, well, over the weekend you do that and then everything is done. Migration could mean you do that for years. And during that time, it really makes sense to have then your legacy applications up and running, and then you can use here the IIOP interaction with the existing CORBA environment, and then after some time that might migrate into your web services environment. And here the RRMI, if you look at Java Remote Method Protocol, that's basically the protocol you use within the RMI environment. If you have an RMI client and an RMI server, they use JRMIP for the interaction. And especially here, if you have the proxy object, then the proxy object sends a message to the remote object here. CORBA uses IIOP. Well, RMI was extended rather early, and that was the initial situation. And now you have the situation that you could say, well, you have something like an RMI IIOP server. It's basically a specialized server which provides more interaction facilities, and therefore in that sense it also supports IIOP. Usually if you stay within the Java environment, you would still continue to use JRMIP because it's a more specialized protocol which works faster in the Java environment because it's targeted to the Java environment. But if you have here a CORBA client, that could use IIOP to interact with the RMI IIOP server. If you have also the possibility, there's the pendant to this type of server, you could also write the RMI IIOP client, which then could also interact with an existing CORBA server. And you could even go ahead and say, well, I write a CORBA server based on Java. And then you would live purely in that environment. You could even write a CORBA server completely based on C++ or completely based on C#. And the question is, basically, well, the what is your primary interaction environment? Is it more here or is it more here? If it's more here, but you want to be open, then it makes sense to provide something like RMI, IIoP server. The one thing what I can quickly distributed com. I think distributed com I will do rather short, because the significance within Microsoft basically it emerges towards zero is now a little bit exaggerated, but it let's say it goes down, because in the same way as Windows does not support Windows XP anymore, it's the intention is that all the people in the Windows environment use .NET and not really distributed COM anymore. And also to say .NET is not a continuation of DCOM. They were developed completely separately, and DCOM came out of COM, and common object model in the easiest way to think of is let's say compound documents. And that's somewhat the was the start of it. And if you use Word and you think of, well, now I have here a spreadsheet, you double click it and then you end up in the spreadsheet program. If you have a graphics, you end up in the graphics program. And in the early stages, Word basically implemented graphics capabilities. Word implemented spreadsheet capabilities, and they noticed it makes it rather hard to continue on with functionality in Word, and it became more and more a monster. And then they came up with these compound documents where they said, well, if we have a spreadsheet in it, you double-click it, and then you're in Excel. And then you modify your spreadsheet, and then when you say, well, you're finished, and then you're back in Word again with your compound document, with your document. And that was somewhat the start of it with these COM. And that was then basically extended to this distributed COM, which basically provide you also access transparency across the network. And they had then here this object model, which was basically here you had the possibility, similarly what you know from IDL and RPC, that you have the possibility here to have objects coming from C++ or Java or even C#. You had an IDL to language compiler. With the IDL language compiler, you basically got the IDL specification, the interface specification. That means the interface to the C++ or Java class, the methods, parameters, and so on. And then you have a compiler which basically generated compiler-specific code of it. The other thing is you had the possibility to make the whole thing faster. Therefore, here you had binary interfaces. In that sense, you had just a table, and the table provided you links and addresses to the methods stored. And therefore, in that sense here, you with the IDL specification, you could directly go to the method address. And here basically you had steps in between. And therefore in that sense it makes it rather fast, and it's programming language independent. Because if the method is already, or the object code is generated, because here you link directly to the object code. And if the object code came from Java or came from C# or whatever, it does not really make any difference. The object, DCOM objects are transient. As soon as an object has no clients anymore, then basically they are destroyed. And therefore, in that sense, you have also something like a garbage collection. And here, a DCOM object is basically an instance of a class. And here, what we point to is to these method implementations of it. And each interface has a unique 128-bit identifier, and that's globally unique. It has a random part of it, and the other one is, as we hear, it consists of a network interface and random number. The architecture, well, that's the architecture, how it looks, and therefore in that sense it has similarities what CORBA has. It has similarities with RPC, remote procedure call, and therefore in that sense, well, you have here the object stub of the remote object, the client proxy you have here, and the COM part and the COM part, and here that's the client object, which basically wants to have an invocation of the remote object. You have here the service control manager, which basically manages the registry, and the registry here records the mappings of file name, including basically the information about the implementation of a class. Because the point is also, if for the class you need the information, you need the class information, because the methods are part of the class information and they are not part of the object itself. In the object, you have only the association to the class as well as the values of the attributes. And the methods are basically stored in the information in the class, and therefore you need the information in which file basically the description of the class is to be found. Also, the service control manager is also responsible for activating objects. Similar what the object adapter does by the CORBA. The main difference, what you see is here, it's you have two types of marshallers. One marshaller you have here in the client proxy and the object stub. And therefore, if you have a client a remote object invocation, then the client proxy basically marshals the parameters of the request and then sends it over. And then here they are demarshaled again, and the method of the object is invoked. And then we have something like a proxy marshaller. And what the proxy marshaller does is, if the client proxy is transmitted from here to here, then the proxy marshaller basically marshals the client proxy, sends it over, and this one demarshals it and then sets it up. And if you think of it, that's not really, if you look at RMI, it's basically, it's all done within the same RMI environment. Here, this one just marshals the requests for the object invocations. This one is basically responsible for transferring the proxy object or the proxy, the client proxy to the client, and then also sets it up here. Therefore, in that sense, it's only relevant for moving stops as well as proxies to that location. And that's, I think, what I wanted to talk about here. And more things is, I mean, in the same sense, you also send a proxy back. And therefore, in the same way as RMI does it, as you remember, you go to the RMI registry, and the registry sends a proxy for the object, for the remote object, back to the client, and you do here something similar. And here you see it once more, object references. Certainly you can hear the information. You can put it up here to the object save server, store here the stub, and here you have, for example, when you do a transfer of object references here, that's the point to transfer object references from A to B. Basically, here is it's stored on the object server, and here A wants to transfer an object reference to B. Therefore, in that sense, it transfers the client proxy here over, and the process A basically here could interact with here this object that's located on the object server. That's not a registry. It's basically here the object server which maintains the object. And now as part, for example, a method invocation, a result is an object ID. And that object ID, it does not make sense to send over here. What it has to, it can't just send here the object ID over, because with an object ID, it's basically a memory address. It doesn't help you to interact with a remote object. Therefore, what it does, it takes the client proxy, the proxy marshaller marshals it, sends it over, and this marshaller then basically sets up the client proxy. And now, here, this can now interact also with the remote object and can basically invoke methods of this remote object. And now this client proxy could disappear, or it's still available for this client application, depending whatever was the result of the method to be invoked here. And that's what happens with the how object references to remote objects are basically transferred within the DCOM environment. And that's also the use of the proxies, the proxy marshaller. This here, it's part of integrate, and that's now actually the if I don't really talk now much of .NET, and it's not really an extension of DCOM. It's completely separately set up. And if you look at it, it's very, very similar what you have already in the Java environment with the enterprise Java beans or enterprise Java environment. And it also provides these two types of things, like this common language runtime, in the same way as you have the Java runtime environment, you have the frame class library, and as part of the common language environment, you have the possibility of services like protected memory management and garbage collection. You have threat management. You have here access to the operating system functions, and you have something like an intermediate language in the same way as you have it in Java. The point, the major difference is here is the Java intermediate language you can execute. In the sense, if you have a Java interpreter, that Java interpreter can then basically execute that virtual or this Java virtual language program. Here, that's not intended for execution. What happens here when it comes to a remote, to a new environment? It supposed that the program is transformed into a local representation. Therefore, in that sense, it's transformed into a local executable program. And it's only intended for an exchange in a heterogeneous environment. That, for example, you could start out in a C++ environment and then go into a Java environment and then map it into the execution of it. And therefore, in that sense, that makes the exchange in a heterogeneous environment rather easy. And the other thing is here it also integrates a type system. Therefore, in the same way as if you have XDR or CDR, you have data structures which provides you a uniform representation, be it object references, be it complex structures, and then it has basic data types like integer, like real, like character, and so on. And in the same way as we had just before with Corba. And then you have also this frame class library, which provides access to functions. And in that sense, the frame class library, you have something like a Microsoft-specific library of functions, similar what you have with enterprise the Java library. And here you have more the generic library, which basically here the frame class library, it's comparable with a Java standard library. Also here comparable with standard Java library, and it in that sense here, this is here independent of the Microsoft environment, and it also provides then here functions for remoting and for remote invocation, and it supports also different protocols in a way. As we had a binary formatting, HTTP, in a similar way as we talked about it in web services with SOAP and XML RPC. Therefore, in that sense, it's pretty much the same, and I don't really want to repeat the same thing what we already talked about in beforehand. The syntax might be slightly different, but then it's mapped here to TCP or mapped to HTTP and using SOAP, and as we heard about it in web services. I think here that's all I wanted to say here. The last part of it, this object-based distributed systems, that would be not part of the exam then. It's just here for information, and it's not part of the exam anymore. And otherwise, the exam is on, I think, the 18th. And there will be a repeat exam sometime in end of September or beginning of October. We don't really know, because the times are set up by the student secretary's office, and they didn't plan the times yet. And therefore, in case if there's a conflict on both, for example, for Erasmus students, then basically you have to check with Angelika Reiser, and she would then come to us, and then we will find a solution of it. But otherwise, we have these two options, and the second, the repeat, we don't really know yet. Thank you. Then I wish you a nice ending of your semester and a nice continuation of the study, and possibly we see us in some other course or some other part of master thesis. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.